So we're talking with Matt Ridley, the rational optimist. What do you have to look forward to in the future? Well, it's a lot more than you think, if the past is any indication, and yet every generation seems to sit there and talk about the future like it's not going to be good. If we knew what we knew now about where we stood in 2010, wouldn't we have been writing a different story back in 1980? The argument of the rational optimist is that that's exactly what's going to happen again. Come the year, say, you know, 2050, we're going to be in a much better place than we are now, and all of the math would seem to agree with him. But what about you? Grab a line if you want, coasttocoastam.com. I want to ask about the future of a couple of specific things. He wrote a book about genomes, and I want to ask him about our genetic future, too, next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We'll start getting calls here in just a second for Matt Ridley, the rational optimist. Do you mind if I broaden the topic base a little bit and ask you about genetics real quickly while we're lining up all the calls?
Please do.
Because your other book, Genome, was obviously an international bestseller too. So when we're talking about the future genetically, I'm reminded of, and this was obviously more of an issue of nutrition perhaps than genetics, but that in the 1950s, Americans were 3 inches taller than they were on average than in the 1900s, correct?
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Okay. So are there genetic changes that could be coming in the future? Do we see anything other than, or are there things that are dormant that are in us right now that scientists are thinking they might be able to activate that would change our future?
I think in terms of sort of natural genetic changes in our species, they are happening. They always will, but they're pretty slow. They're glacially slow compared with the kinds of things that we've been talking about in terms of technology and so on. You can think of genes that are probably spreading at the moment. For example, you know, incompetence in the use of contraceptives is probably spreading, you know,
right,
et cetera, or whatever. There is certain, you know, there's probably an increase in infertility. Why? Because we're making infertile people capable of breeding. And so they're passing on their infertility, et cetera.
Oh, but that's very interesting. I never thought of that before. That's what increases infertility rates.
Well, not all infertility is heritable, but some is. And that, you know, the, for example, there's a technology for infertility treatment which involves injecting sperm into eggs when the sperm are not mobile. And if that's heritable, then, yeah, that's going to be passed on. But it's not but these kind of things are relatively slow and relatively minor compared with the changes in our lives that come about not through genes. But I think you did hint also at the possibility that some of the things we do will, as it were, wake up things
right
in our genome. And I think that does happen more than we perhaps realize, I also wrote a book called Nature Via Nurture, and it's about how nurture switches on aspects of our nature and different ways that you bring people up elicit different parts of their genome, if you like, bring on stream different programs that are there, that are either there or not. And so bringing people up in a highly technological world with a lot of computer games is quite different from bringing them up in a industrial society where you send them up chimneys at the age of five or whatever, and enables them to probably express their genome more freely, if you like, during their lives. And there's evidence that early experience, for example, the more diverse and rich your early experience, the better your brain will develop. That's in a sense a genetic phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of calling on the genes in the right order and in the most rich way.
I share a common ancestor with Reginald Crendel Punnett, who is the inventor of Punnett Squares, the geneticist that helped, you know, sort of put the blueprint out there for many of us to kind of figure out how genes work. And I often
Absolutely.
Wonder.
He was a very famous early geneticist around the turn of the 20th century, wasn't he?
Yeah, there's not that many. No, actually, even later. He was, I think he, Punnett Squares and were more of a mid Well, anyway, I never knew him, but I have family members that were lived concurrently with him. And it was interesting because I just think that there's at the time that seemed so exotic, conversations about genes and about DNA. It just seems so, you know, and now it's just something we talk about all the time, and we're living with it, and we're going to be living with it even more, I think, in the near future. Let's get to Tom in San Diego on Coast to Coast for Matt Ridley, author of The Rational Optimist. Tom?
Hello, Ian, and hello, Mr. Ridley. Great program, very inspiring. Mr. Ridley, you base human progress on three legs, and that is rationality, the free exchange of ideas, and energy. And your optimistic view kind of reminds me of the Star Trek Federation. Unfortunately, we haven't examined the power of the Borg. Wherever there's a federation, there's a Borg. And Borg, as I view it, is in opposition to all those three elements that you've described. And as I see them, it basically you've got a small number of ruthless, power-mad, greedy individuals exploiting the uninformed. And if you take a look, let's go in reverse order. Let's take a look at energy, for example. You got the founder of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore. He supports the safest, cleanest, cheapest form of energy that this country invented, which is nuclear power, and yet we're not able to use this invention. We can export it to other countries, but we can't even use it in our own country because we've got an irrational Borg that you know, in the form like Al Gore, who for monetary greed, he actually shut down during the Clinton administration when he was vice president. He shut down nuclear power and just happens to be invested in all kinds of coal projects, which have brought him in millions of dollars at the same time that decries global warming. He's now has bought a $5 million house on the
Well, let's get to a question, Tom. I think this is fine, but let's get to a question here for Matt. Go ahead.
Well, the question is how can we get to a beautiful future when we've got greedy, corrupt people that have blinded people like zombies? And I think of this Borg as a Democrat Party with a few collaborators from the Country Club Republicans.
Well, Tom, I think actually just to be that's an interesting summation. I think a lot of Democrats would totally disagree with you. Many Democrats are really pushing for the return of nuclear power. So I'm not sure I agree with that final conclusion, but go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do to some extent agree. I mean, you know, we can agree or disagree about specifics of what's being said there, but in terms of the way in which is government the problem or government the solution, I agree that there is a tendency for people in positions of power to be subject to pressure groups from special interests, which prevents them allowing this kind of economic progress that I've been talking about to happen. If you look at the history of government over centuries, it's not a terribly encouraging one. I'm thinking of people like the Ming emperors, who had a very, very prosperous society, and they managed to shut that down by getting in the way of free and fair exchange and by not developing energy and not being rational, as you say. Now, our government is a huge amount better, surely, than the Ming emperors in all sorts of ways. And on the whole, my argument is that despite the best efforts of some politicians, and there are others, of course, who are trying to encourage these things, despite the best efforts of some politicians, the progress does continue and will win out because the superiority of certain technologies, whether in energy or other fields, will show their effects. But you're right, there are times when one feels that this is not going to happen and that somebody's going to be able to shut this down. One of the key features of history is that when one regime prevents progress, somewhere else the torch is kept alight. Now, hopefully that'll happen in this century too, but I suppose it's just conceivable that if we all got together as a world and decided we must have one world policy on something, as, for example, over climate change, there have been attempts to initiate that sort of process, then we may not have a backup to show us when we've gone wrong. And one of the things I like about fragmented government is it does give us a backup program to look back and say, hang on, this we went wrong in this respect. We should adopt this idea from other people.
You know, I keyed in on something Tom was saying there. He wanted to put all the black hats on all the Democrats and say they're the Borg, and that with a few, you know, Republicans thrown in there, that the Republicans are the white hats guys. And I think that's a tendency that a lot of people have, regardless of whether they think all the Republicans wear black hats or whether, you know, these are party names, which we don't even use in this country, to always be looking in terms of our future, in terms of the enemies and the good guys, or for even that idea that for every Star Trek Federation, there's a Borg. And I don't know that that's always true. I think sometimes we create boogeymen because they help us bring coalitions together, and that the power of the boogeymen is actually bigger than the boogeymen themselves.
I agree with you on that, and I do think that that we have a tendency to polarize issues, political issues in particular, much too much, and see it in terms of us and them, and that in a sense is a sort of old, much older human instinct that goes back to competition between groups, between bands of apes and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm like Tom, I have my views about which political party is right on which particular issue, but I tend to take my views in a kind of a la carte way. You know, I like the in my country it's conservatives, liberal democrats and labor. I like conservatives on some issues, liberal democrats on other issues, and labor on some issues.
Well, we all take turns, you know, being the cops and being the robbers, I think, in some respects. So we have to be kind of good with that idea. We can't just we'll get to a couple other callers here. For Matt Ridley, the rational optimist, will go with Jan in Brooklyn on Coast to Coast. Jan?
Howdy. I just want to read you one quick sentence from USA Today. Because the technology involving introducing genes from one plant or bacteria into another and combination not found in nature, they believe it can never be safe. And also, I can't have the papaya, makes me sick. It feels horrible. The globe grapes that are GMO feel horrible. In Europe, something came out, and all the European countries banned GMO. In India, farmers are killing themselves because the cotton GMO is not working out good. Animals they can't get the sperm and everything. The worst thing with GMO is that when it gets into your genes, it gets into the DNA of the cell, and the bacteria multiply, and the parasites, the pesticides multiply. How could you just be so cavalier saying it's okay?
Okay, go ahead, Matt.
I think there's a lot there that Jan is saying, which is not actually true, is not what's actually happening. For example, when you genetically modify an organism, you don't. We're all organisms have genes in them. We're eating genes all the time. You're simply taking a gene from one organism, putting it to another. You change the genes anyway in every plant and every crop that we grow, we've changed the genes in. We've just done it in different ways. GMO is just a new way of doing it. And as for the health effects of GMO, there just simply aren't any. There's billions and billions of people eating this stuff around the world, and there is no evidence of any effect on human health. In the case of India and cotton, actually, it was the Indian farmers who rioted, saying we want access to this technology because we can see that this cotton, which is insect resistant, is not going to succumb to the kinds of insect pests that have been damaging our crops to the same extent. The result is that the amount of pesticide used on genetically modified cotton is down by about 80% worldwide. That's wonderful. It means that insects which are not eating the cotton, but are passing by are no longer being killed. And that means there are birds and so on. So I think the environmental benefits of GMOs are considerable. Now, I'm not saying every single one is a good thing. Some are good things, some are bad. It's a technology like cooking or something. You can do it badly or you can do it well. But I do believe that it is a very useful tool in helping us to improve crops for human health and for the environmental health as well.
Doesn't that make you feel better, Jan?
No, they're putting bacteria. He's making it sound like it's nothing. They're putting these strange bacteria into the plant, and these bacteria then grow in the person's body.
Okay, go ahead.
It's not a question of putting bacteria into the plants. What it is a question of using a bacterial gene to get the gene into the plants. But the gene comes from, the gene is what goes in, not the bacterium. We eat bacteria all the time. I mean, cheese is full of bacteria. That's why it tastes good. But genetically modified bacteria are used in laboratories to produce things like insulin, which save diabetics' lives and so on. There's no question of actually taking bacteria and putting them into plants.
Les is in Fairlawn, New Jersey, on Coast to Coast for Matt Ridley, the rational optimist about the future. Les?
Good morning. One thing that your guest has not mentioned is how we become dependent on our technology. For example, the electric power system. One of your guests recently on Coast to Coast explained that nuclear weapons produce certain energy that can destroy electric wires, computers, etc., and that just three nuclear weapons, perhaps from a country like North Korea or Iran, exploded at high altitude, could knock out all the electricity in the United States.
Right.
And all the telephone.
Yep.
And sooner or later, the gas and the water would also and the cars would also stop because they have some extra generators or batteries, but they won't last forever.
Yeah.
And this might take years to repair because you need factories to make new power plants, but you need power plants to power the factories. So basically, we could be years without electricity, water, natural gas, cars or trucks, telephones, computers, etc. In
right.
other words, an enormous disaster.
Let's Matt, chance to respond to Les.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, I've certainly heard that nuclear weapons can cause an electromagnetic pulse, which would ruin a lot of electronic devices. I didn't know it would actually knock out power stations. I'm not sure I necessarily accept that's a real threat from, I mean, obviously, if you hit a nuclear power station with a nuclear weapon, you're going to knock it out. But in terms of knocking out ones that don't get hit, I would need to see the studies that show that is really a threat. But you're right in the general point that you know, in the modern world, we are dependent on technologies. We're dependent on ships crossing the oceans. We're dependent on factories, and we're dependent on communications to keep us going. But it's better than being at the mercy of local phenomena, when in the past a storm or a drought would wipe out the local food supply and people would genuinely starve because it wasn't possible to get backup food from somewhere else. Likewise, the technologies that we use in terms of communication and so on were much more limited. So I think, yes, we are vulnerable to attacks on our technologies, of course, and I'm all for making us less so. But I don't believe we're any more vulnerable for being interconnected in this way.
Les, isn't that good news?
I don't agree, no.
Are you not optimistic about our future?
There are so many things that are wrong that your guest is not talking about, not just technology, but all sorts of things. Like in medicine, for example, prescription medications, according to a study published in JAMA a few years ago, prescription medications kill at least 76,000 patients per year.
All right.
And well, let's also save a lot of lives.
Matt, I'm going to have you address that coming up just after this. You're going to have to listen off the air for your answer. Let him respond to that. They kill 76,000 people a year, prescription meds. What would Matt Ridley, the rational optimist, say in response to that next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. All right, so heading into our last half hour, your questions for Matt Ridley. We'll pick it up right where we did. Les in New Jersey was saying that there's much more reasons to be pessimistic than Matt Ridley has mentioned. So we asked him for another example, and he said pharmaceuticals. Let's talk about that coming up next. What is there to be optimistic about there? Bad prescriptions kill a lot of people. So take that, Matt Ridley. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so Les said before we went to the bottom of the hour that you, Matt Ridley, are ignoring these things to be pessimistic about, such as the failure of pharmaceuticals. Where are you with that, Matt?
Well, my argument would be that after having benefited in my life from vaccines, antivirals, antibiotics, painkillers, and all these other pharmaceuticals, I think that actually I'm a lot better off than I would have been 50 years before. That does not mean, however, and I think Les has a good point here, that everything is perfect. Quite the reverse. There are indeed some prescription meds that kill people and others that don't do as much good as they could. I don't know whether the figure of 76,000 people who die from prescription meds is right, but he's absolutely right that the world is not as good as it could be. That's quite different from saying it's better than it was, which is what I'm saying, and that it's going to get better. I think that it is actually because there's so much still wrong with the world, particularly far bigger problem than prescription meds, the poverty, malnutrition, and disease that plagues a lot of the developing world. It's because there's so much wrong with the world that we must bear in mind how much better we can make it and how much better we can go on making it. And so I'm not saying in my book or in any of my arguments that everything's fine. Quite the reverse. I'm saying there's a lot still wrong, but we have a process that improves things, and let's try and make sure it goes on doing so.
How prosperity evolves is the subtitle of the book, The Rational Optimist. I'll go back to the pharmaceutical thing. I'm actually surprised that the figure would be that low, 76,000 a year. Low to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, inevitably, any chemicals that you put in your system that are designed to change your system are bound to have risks. And one of the things that I'm excited about is the degree to which genomics is giving us the ability to predict who will react in different ways to particular drugs so that you can avoid giving the drugs to people who are going to be harmed by them, or even to people who are not going to benefit from them, because the interaction between your genes and how you metabolize these drugs tells you whether they're going to work or not. So I think actually that's something where we are going to see huge improvements in terms of not giving these drugs to people who are either not benefiting from them or actually going to be harmed by them. Well, to give Les some credit again, I do think that there is there is an issue that the pharmaceutical industry has an incentive to come forward with drugs. Yeah. It doesn't have quite such a big incentive to spot the problems with them. Although it does have some incentive to avoid killing people, obviously, because it gets in trouble if it does.
Well, and I think we talked earlier about, the statins were misused and that they pushed drugs that are out on the public that don't do what they say they're supposed to do or do it differently for different people, and they make claims that can't be substantiated, like a lot of the SSRIs, a lot of these antidepressants, I think, are a problem. But I do think that we have to look at the fact that we live a lot longer, and all of us are living longer. I mean, if the world were such an unhealthy place to be in, you think that the average lifespan would be going down, and it's gone up dramatically. Talk a little bit about the history of lifespans before we get back to the calls.
Yeah, I mean, in 150 years or so, lifespans have doubled. In my lifetime, they've gone up a third. They're going up at the rate of about 5 hours a day, which is a rather interesting phenomenon.
That's
every day
amazing.
That you live longer, you increase your chances of living. I mean, you increase your lifespan by 5 years, as it were. That's all across the globe. They're going up faster than that in the developing world. That's coming about because of the conquest of disease. But if you look back at what people were saying about lifespan only 25 years ago, they were saying, we are now putting so many chemicals into our environment
this was a very common view, and people like Paul Ehrlich were saying this, that there is a cancer epidemic coming which is going to shorten lifespan. That was almost an unexceptional remark to make in the 1970s, particularly in the environmental movement, that lifespan was going to fall because of chemicals causing cancer. Well, the amount of cancer, age-adjusted, is falling. I mean, you're more likely to get cancer if you live longer, but cancer is coming later in people's lives. And when it's coming, it's more curable. It's by no means entirely curable yet, of course. A lot of it is not curable, but there are treatments that work for some cancers now, and I think we're going to see more of them. So actually, the picture is of much greater health, and towards the end of our lives, we're healthy right up until the end more. We spend a longer time living and a shorter time dying, as someone put it.
That's well put. Mike is in San Francisco on Coast to Coast, west of the Rockies, for Matt Ridley. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Much of what you were saying in my listening was, things are getting better because we have all these appliances and gadgets now, and that, isn't wonderful. We can communicate with this and et cetera. And I argue that a lot of that came out of the space program, that probably the pinnacle of our engineering ability, and at least in this the Western civilization, was being able to get to the moon, and that was built with a slide rule, and now we have all these computers and what have you. Kids have gadgets and stuff, and there a lot of that stuff is just distraction. It's not facilitating. I mean, mapping the genome, I agree, was done with a computer, and it was a fabulous thing. I just think at some level there's a lot of the stuff we've created is just kind of a bunch of BS.
I got a question, Mike. Are you really telling me that you think we didn't have any computers in NASA to get us to the
computer that NASA had on the space on board when we went to the moon was about as powerful as a pocket calculator.
I don't mean on board. I mean.
No,
in
didn't.
General, didn't
no,
computers
no, no,
haven't
no,
played
no,
a big part?
No, the Gemini project and all that stuff; those were all done with slide rules. The SR-71 still holds the speed record, Ian, for the fastest plane in the world, and Kelly Johnson designed that with a slide rule.
No, I understand, but I think there were computers there. I mean, I'm not saying that slide rules weren't very cool.
There were onboard computers. No, and
I don't mean on board. I mean that in general for doing the computer.
No, most of that stuff was done with slide rules.
All right, go ahead.
Okay,
Matt,
wait.
Let's get our guest a chance to respond. Go ahead, Matt. You want to get in there on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got a good point. We did amazing things without sophisticated computers, and reaching the moon was a wonderful example of that. I would argue that although you can say that a lot of what's done with computers nowadays is a waste of time, my daughter uses a computer to chat with her friends on Facebook. But if that's what people want to do, let them do it. You know, I mean, and an awful lot of, my ability to go online and order a product from around the world or to connect with a like-minded group of people, they're not trivial achievements. A lot of people are getting access to social support and other things through the online mechanisms. And going to the moon, you and I might think it was wonderful, but actually what did it really achieve in terms of improving people's living standards or even their imaginations? It hasn't had a huge impact there. So I think one could make the same criticism in the other direction, if you see what I mean.
You wouldn't agree with Mike's point that it was the pinnacle of our achievement and that from this, after going to the moon, everything's kind of down from there?
No, I wouldn't. I would say that from the point of view of my life, the invention of the search engine, which is something I use all day and every day just to connect with articles I want to read or information I want to look up. Ian, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you were related to Reginald Punnett. I had heard of him, but I didn't know very much about him. In one of the breaks, I just looked him up, and I discovered that he was really the pioneer of translating genetics for the general public and wrote the first genetics textbook. And so I tread in his footsteps, and I think that's wonderful, and I want to know more about him now. You can argue that going to the moon was a greater achievement than that, but it was. I don't want to denigrate it, but it's in terms of the effect on most people's lives, some of this online stuff, some of the stuff computers are achieving, You know, they're saving lives in hospitals and all sorts of things. There are real things happening that are not as epic as going to the moon, but they are great all the same.
I just did, to Mike's point, I used a search engine to look up slide rule. So I'll worship the slide rule when I get off the air here coming up. And Michael's in Hamilton, Ontario, and then we'll get to the Skype line in just a second. Michael?
Hi there.
You're talking with Matt Ridley. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was wanted to take you guys back earlier to when you were saying how we might not see peace in the 21st century. I've been reading up on, I don't know if you've heard of him, Dr. Carl Johan Kellerman. He's been spending about, I think, 20 years of his life researching the Mayan calendar. I'm not going to get into much of what he was saying, but one of the points that he had said was that because of the Internet, even just in the past 15 years, we've had a lot more communication, and that helps further our evolution because, coming up to the next couple of years, he was saying that it's actually beneficial for us now because we have the Internet now, and it's giving out more information, helping people become more aware of what's going on in their world rather than just what's happening in the community. My question is, what do you think about that? Do you think that that the Internet is helping us bring together a more peaceful world?
Well, I do think that it's absolutely right that communication across the Internet is having a dramatic effect on the ability to bring together ideas. As I said earlier, someone can post an engineering problem that they've got that they want to solve on the Internet and can get people to write in with solutions all over the world. That kind of thing's happening, and that's a really exciting. That must be accelerating the rate of innovation, the rate of problem solving. The question as to whether it creates peace, I guess the kind of thing you're talking about is that on a FaceLine chat show, somebody in Argentina can talk to someone in Chile, and that means they're less likely to go to war with each other as countries or something like that. And I hope that's a possibility, and I think it is. I think it's going to be harder to go to take your country to war with another country saying that they're all evil, when they can go online and see that the people in the other country are not all evil, that most of them are nice guys. So, yes, I do think it will reduce the probability of war, but I don't think it will extinguish it, I'm afraid.
Skype line, Robert is in Orange County, California, on Coast to Coast for Matt Ridley. Go ahead, Robert.
Mr. Ridley is either tragically misinformed or intentionally deceptive about the GMO technology issue. From Jeff Smith's Seeds of Deception to documentaries like The World According to Monsanto to many previous Coast guests, this issue is very highly weighted against Mr. Ridley.
All right. Let's give him a chance to respond. Well, Robert, let's give him a chance to respond. Go ahead. Matt?
Well, I've looked at this closely. I've followed it for many years and written about it, and I've talked to a lot of people involved on both sides of the argument, and I'm seeing zero health problems, huge environmental benefits, and genuine opportunities for making things even better. Just an example, there's a firm in California which has just introduced a gene from barley into rice, which enables the rice plant to be more efficient in capturing nitrogen from the soil, which means that with half the artificial fertilizer applied, you can grow the same yield of crop. Now, that could transform the lives, particularly of African farmers who are relatively unable to get synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. And that company that developed it, Arcadia Biosciences, they've actually licensed that technology entirely free through a charity for use in Africa by smallholder farmers. There may be drawbacks to that technology. We'll find out. But it seems to me that we mustn't cut ourselves off from the possible benefits as well as the disadvantages.
Robert?
Mr. Ridley, the USD, Monsanto is in bed with the USDA, just like pharmaceuticals are in bed with the FDA. It's, it's been written about, it's been documented, And I hope to be able to email you at some time to bring you up to date on this issue. And I thank you.
Yeah, okay, fine. Good luck with that.
Thank you, Robert. My website is rationaloptimist.com. Very nice to hear from you.
Naomi is in Fullerton, California, on Coast to Coast for Matt Ridley. Go ahead, Naomi.
Yes, the gentleman that just called. I was going to ask Mr. Ridley the same question, if he's seen the documentary on the Weather Channel and on the National Geographic Channel that was done in France and in Mexico and everything, about because of the NAFTA agreement under Clinton, not only about the cotton in France and India, the genetically modified. Do you know that on the current Supreme Court of the United States and a lot of members of the FDA go back and forth between Monsanto, one of the Supreme Court members of the U.S. is used to be a former employee of Monsanto, and 70% of the soybean crops in the United States are owned by the seeds are owned by Monsanto.
Okay, well, let's give Matt Ridley a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Well, Monsanto is a very big player in the genetically modified food game, but it's not the only one. There are, there's someone like Ingo Patricus in Switzerland who came up with a way of enriching rice with vitamins, so that people who are dependent on rice for their diet don't go blind as a result of vitamin A deficiency and things like that. He developed that. He had to pay no royalties because a lot of the companies whose technologies he borrowed for doing that waived their rights to royalties. He did it as a non-profit. And yet that rice has not been licensed in countries yet because it's still undergoing trials and it's tied up in red tape, a lot of which were urged on governments by environmental organizations. Yet there is very, very little evidence of risk, and meanwhile people are still going blind for lack of vitamin A. It's not the only solution to that, but it's a potential solution. I just feel that there is a huge diversity of things going on in genetic modification here, and the risks that were predicted at the beginning of this episode simply are not materializing.
Mike is in Ithaca, California, on Coast to Coast for Matt Ridley. Mike?
Hello, Dr. Ridley and Ian. I have a question, Dr. Ridley, that I asked you once about 5 years ago on another program, but the current audience wasn't there, and I didn't...
Nice to hear you again, Mike.
Pardon?
Nice to hear you again.
Oh, thank you. And I didn't get your answer because of static. But you used a word like Jaeger experiment. If it wasn't Jaeger, I'd like to know what the word was. But what the question was is, if someone from another civilization, from another solar system, were to discover us, and they were to ask the question whether we are robots or whether we are spiritual beings. In other words, are we some ones or some things?
Mike, we're going to have to get to this question fast.
Yes.
We're running out of time.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The way that they would do that is if someone had an operation that produced a pollutant, and he chose whether to neutralize it or to dilute it.
We're running way out of time here, Mike. Can we get a response? Matt, do you know what he's talking about?
I don't. I'm afraid I can't remember what the Jaeger experiment is, so I'm not able to help this time either. But
go ahead and give your email out again so that somebody like Mike can get a hold of you, because we're just out of time.
Rationaloptimist.com.
Okay.
And I'll do my best to get a response.
Good. And so Mike, just remind him that we ran out of time and couldn't get your whole question in, and you guys can sort that out later on. Thank you so much. I think this is a terrific book, and I think it's its own kind of manifesto for liberals and conservatives to reconsider the future and to feel good about the possibilities that exist out there, that it's going to be better than the pessimists think, and it's coming faster than any of us can imagine. So thank you so much.
It's a privilege to be on the show. Thank you, Ian.
Well, you're sweet to say that. Thank you so much, and look forward to finishing the book myself. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.